Hi, I'm Clement Liu. Welcome to Season 4 of Just Sustainability. We'll begin Marceline Mosher's second episode with a tangential question that I asked her. After Marceline mentioned that she sometimes responds to moments of darkness by reading the stories written by the children that she's worked with, I wanted to ask her about hope and how we might best appeal to hope in our narratives about sustainability and the environment. That question led Marceline to discuss her research concerning framing discourse about climate change within the news media in terms of public health.
I'm going to ask you like a super tangential question that has like, that just sort of just spun off of like what you said, right? Like noting the sort of darkness that, you know, one might experience when one thinks about climate change a lot, right? Or like one follows sort of the literature about climate change. And then like this idea of hope. I'm just curious how like, right? So like, there's an interesting sort of controversy about hope that seems to be happening right now, right? Like some folks are a little concerned that like narratives of hope might, in fact, be false hope and right in misleading. And then when you're right, we don't get the outcomes that like we hope we get, then that might lead to despair in ways that like lead us to like stop trying. But I'm curious, like, right, like when you're thinking about like telling these stories and like thinking about, you know, communication when it comes to environment, where there really is a difficulty with it being very easy to despair, right? So like my students always ask me about like how do I deal with like, you know, the despair that might arise from thinking about and working on problems related to sustainability, because some of them, right, they seem so intractable, or like they seem like, right, like they seem like, right, like we've passed certain tipping points, or like they seem like, you know, right, like there is resistance that like make people lose faith in like humanity and things like that. So I mean, I'm just, right, like I don't have a well-formed question here. I'm just curious how you think about that, and like when you're, you know, thinking about narratives that are intended to help us be better at, you know, relating with the rest of nature. How do you think about that? Like, how do you think about like the despair and hope and storytelling?
I have a multi-part answer for you.
Sure.
I'm sure you're familiar with Davis Wallace Wells and Catherine Hayhoe. They are kind of at the polar opposite end of how to communicate about climate change, right? Uh-huh. Where Wallace Wells is helping us to understand the deeply existential, right? Like the existential nature of the crisis, right? With all of these worst case scenario, like, friends, we don't have time or luxury to talk about hope. This is what's going to happen, right?
Right.
And then where Catherine Hayhoe is like, friends, the most important thing that we can do in the face of, you know, this challenge is to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some scholars, you know, there's debate about the efficacy of fear appeals versus kind of more hopeful or positive appeals. And of course, there's points of privilege wrapped up in conversations of either, right? Like who's most being impacted by climate change are not the folks who are contributing most to climate change, right? Mm-hmm. But I think that the reality lies in understanding your audience,
sure,
first and foremost, and understanding the, you know, regardless of the, you know, enormity of the problem. And yeah, there are all these really powerful, you know, realities that can be really packaged effectively as fear-based appeals. Mm-hmm. And I think for some audiences, that is really effective. I think for many, it's not, right? Especially when we think about, you know, we don't need to talk to people at the end of the extremes, right? We don't need to try to convince forgive me, Edward Maybach, I'm not going to remember the percentages, but you know, the the disinterested or the folks who just absolutely think climate change is a fraud, right? And then those who are passionately, you know, invested and believe, and they want, we as scholars, we don't necessarily need to be talking to the folks at the end, right? Either. We need to be talking to folks at the middle. And so understanding what kind of messages work best with, you know, not only the individuals, but the kinds of groups that we may have an opportunity to speak with, to write to, you know, to get our messages out to, they're often mixed, right? And so if you're speaking to mixed groups of people, maybe the fear-based appeals aren't going to be the most effective. And Hayhoe's, her whole thing is that the way that we can move conversations forward, the way that we can find deepening or deepened understandings of things across difference is through finding commonality, right? Common shared values and tapping into, hey, you value, you know, being able to fish in your most beloved trout stream, you know, let's talk about what climate change is doing to that trout stream, right? And so with that in the background of my answer, I will continue to say, so the much of the work that I'm focused on is how we communicate about climate change as an issue of public health. And so again, it's really human focused, and that's partly because when we test these different frames, and I'm mostly talking about this through a news media lens, but it also applies to interpersonal conversation. It applies to, you know, it applies to a number of things, but most of my scholarship, of course, is examinations of news media. So when we talk about climate change as an issue of, you know, environmental degradation.
Thank you. It is a weird string of phonemes to tie together and try to say.
Thank you. Thank you for helping me out. I wasn't going to get there. So thank you. So the environmental frame, an economic issue, right? There's all of these common ways that we talk about climate change. And it turns out that the two most common ways that we talk about climate change, again, in the news media, are environmental or economic. And they're the two most divisive ways we can talk about it.
Sure.
And so there's been a lot of research, and that's been driven by a number of amazing scholars. I was introduced to it by one of my mentors, Dr. Melinda Weathers, and her work with Edward Maybach and so many others. Sorry, there's dozens of them. They honed in this, you know, there's probably, you know, half a dozen or a dozen scholars who really honed in on testing the efficacy of this frame.
Yeah.
And it turns out that communicating about climate change as an issue of public health is really effective. And it crosses political ideology. It crosses depth of interest, right? Like, how interested are you in climate change? You can be relatively uninterested, but if you see an article about, you know, increased tips in your community and, you know, tick-borne illnesses, you're more likely to read more of that article than you are to read something about polar ice caps melting or, you know, the economic impacts of green energy, right? And so I'm really interested in understanding how, and I won't go off into a million details because that's where I live in the weeds, but nobody wants me to be there for this. But
no, weeds are perfectly fine.
Okay.
This is an opportunity to get out in the weeds. Yeah, get out in the weeds.
Yay. Okay. So I'm really interested in, so I'll tell you just one, I'll just tell you a little bit. So the public health frame has been tested, and it's been found to be effective for three reasons. One, it deals with some of the logistical challenges of communicating about climate change generally, right? It's ambiguous. It's scientifically technical, confusing. Yeah. There's supposed, you know, the jury's out on consensus, you know, supposedly it's obviously not. It's temporally and geographically distant in many people's minds, right? It's perceived as distant. All of these challenges about communicating with climate change can be addressed with the public health frame, right? We can make it really immediate. We can make it local. It can be personally relevant. It can be tangible. We can take it out of the confusing, like, weather? What's climate, right? We can take it out of those conversations and into really tangible things. also the sources are more seen to be more credible and trustworthy, right? Like who are you, who do you want to listen to more? A politician, a pundit, you know, some economist, a school teacher, a scientist, or a doctor. Apparently, right. Doctors are, you know, rated among the highest, right? They're up there with people we know and trust. Doctors are rated as really effective deliverers of information about things that impact us, like climate change.
Right.
And then finally, because mitigating actions also benefit us, right, from the health lens. So if we are trying to mitigate and, you know, reduce our carbon emissions, we can eat less red meat. We can ride our bikes to work, right? We can take these actions that are also really good for our physical and mental health. And so those are the reasons that scholars are, you know, positing for and testing. And that's what they found, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the public health frame is really, it's been shown to be really effective. Here's the challenge in my research, and you know, in my research is furthering Dr. Weather's work.
Mm-hmm.
But it's showing that news coverage that evokes a public health frame is like this tiny fraction, right? And when you think about, okay, well, does that mean that we need to have, you know, the primacy, the primary frame of an article? Does it need to be discussed as? Does the headline and lead paragraph need to be grounded in a public health impact for folks to, you know, have that effect? Or should we be just having really strong public health impact statements in more articles? You know, if we're not going to be able to get the news media to start to more regularly cover impacts of climate change through this public health lens, can we at least get them to include public health statements, right? So that's where my work is starting to go, because we've looked at news coverage across three different periods of time, and it just, the public health frame, even though it's been shown to be more effective, is not gaining any, you know, footing. Environmental and economic frames still rule the day.
Yeah.
And so that's a really long, multifaceted answer, but really at my base, hope has a place for me personally because it helps to drive me forward. But I think hope is it's a luxury and a privilege. I'm not losing access to my livelihood or my home or water, right?
Right.
So I can still have hope, but I recognize that as a privilege, and I use it to propel me because I understand, you know, that my work, I need to keep being a part of the solution. And one way I need to do that is by having hope. That's my answer.
Well, okay. No, that's a perfect answer. That's a great answer. Cause it leads me to another question, which is, so why do you think it's the case that, right, despite the fact that public health is resonant, that isn't the story that's entering into the coverage, right? Like, why does the coverage continue to be one about environmental harm and like economic harm rather than public health harm? Is it right? Like, actual media sources tend to not recognize public health as being a climate change issue? Or is it that, right, folks who are doing research on climate change tend to write about it in terms of economics and environmental harms, and so that's just what's available to be reported on?
I think you get at the age-old question of is media a reflection of society, or, you know, chief in constructing the discourse, right?
Right.
And that isn't precisely where you're going.
No.
That's where it brings me, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's a little bit of both, right? Which is my answer to the aforementioned question. But I think it's largely a symptom of a media ecosystem that is grounded in a for-profit model. And I think that when attention is, and that's not to say that journalists individually aren't, you know, brilliant, skeptical, critical, amazing curators of knowledge, right, and and discourse. I'm so grateful for journalists and media. But I do think that the ecosystem that many of these stories are a part of kind of demands that conflict frame, that episodic frame, those stories. So when the public health frame is evoked, it's often in response to some reporting that has shown, you know, like one of my favorite examples is, you know, sperm count is impacted by heat waves, right? So when that scientific study came out, there's, you know, this percolation of these public health reports, and that would, you know, maybe be the only public health frame at that whole, you know, outlet for that whole year, right? And right. So I think the same challenges that, you know, the same things that we are critical of news media for, they impact this effective frame. I also think that it isn't as maybe popular, but I do think the public health angle in like the scientific world and scholarship is gaining popularity. But again, that may be my position in the field. And then lastly, I think that there are some, and Colin Agar at the Humphrey School at the U is, one of his questions of me was, what about explanatory journalism, which is a part of online news media presence, right?
Like
The Guardian and many of these other resources. So that I'm going to start to look at explanatory journalism and, you know, maybe you'll find the public health frame in different new, and rather than legacy, you know, news media that is, I am looking at online articles, but outlets that were not formed in that same ecosystem.
At this point, our conversation takes a sharp turn in regards to the topic. So such being the case, I'll end this episode here. In the next episode of Just Sustainability, we'll shift from Marceline and I talking about framing the discourse about climate change in terms of public health to us talking about how to have more intentional conversations. Thank you for listening to Just Sustainability. If you've enjoyed what you heard, please support this podcast by subscribing and leaving a review. Just Sustainability is recorded with the support of the Institute of the Environment at the University of Minnesota. In particular, I want to thank Peter Levin and Beth Mercer-Taylor for all their help with this show. All the music on Just Sustainability is composed and recorded by Clifton Nesseth, and all the artwork was created by Kristen Nesseth. Thank you again for listening.